Chapter 35. The Colosseum. France had so managed his route that during the ride to the Colosseum they passed not a single ancient ruin, so that no gradual preparation was made on the mind for the colossal proportions of the gigantic building they came to admire. This itinerary possessed another great advantage, that of leaving France at full liberty to indulge his deep reverie upon the subject of the story recounted by Maître Pastrini, in which his mysterious host of the Isle of Monte Cristo was so strangely mixed up. Seated with folded arms in a corner of the carriage, he continued to ponder over the singular history he had so lately listened to, and to ask himself an interminable number of questions touching its various circumstances, without, however, arriving at a satisfactory reply to any of them. One fact, more than the rest, brought his friend Sinbad the Sailor back to his recollection, and that was the mysterious sort of intimacy that seemed to exist between the brigands and sailors, and Pastrini's account of Vampa's having found refuge on board the vessels of smugglers and fishermen reminded France of the two Corsican bandits he had found supping so amicably with the crew of the little yacht which had even deviated from its course and touched at Porto Vecchio for the sole purpose of landing them. The very name assumed by his host of Monte Cristo, and again repeated by the landlord of the Hôtel de Londres, abundantly proved to him that his island friend was playing his philanthropic part equally on the shores of Piombino, Civitavecchia, Ostia, and Gaeta, as on those of Corsica, Tuscany, and Spain. And further, France bethought him of having heard his singular entertainer speak both of Tunis and Palermo, proving thereby how largely his circle of acquaintances extended. But however the mind of the young man might be absorbed in these reflections, they were at once dispersed at the sight of the dark, frowning ruins of the stupendous Colosseum, through the various openings of which the pale moonlight played and flickered like the unearthly gleam from the eyes of the wandering dead. The carriage stopped near the Meta Sudans. The door was opened, and the young men, eagerly alighting, found themselves opposite a cicerone, who appeared to have sprung up from the ground, so unexpected was his appearance. The usual guide from the hotel having followed them, they had paid two conductors. Nor is it possible at Rome to avoid this abundant supply of guides. Besides the ordinary cicerone, who seizes upon you directly you set foot in your hotel, and never quits you while you remain in the city, there is also a special cicerone belonging to each monument, nay, almost to each part of a monument. As for Albert and Franz, they essayed not to escape from their Ciceronian tyrants, and indeed it would have been so much the more difficult to break their bondage, as the guides alone are permitted to visit these monuments with torches in their hands. Thus then the young men made no attempt at resistance, but blindly and confidingly surrendered themselves into the care and custody of their conductors. Albert had already made 7 or 8 similar excursions to the Colosseum, while his less favoured companion trod for the first time in his life the classic ground forming the monument of Flavius Vespasian. And to his credit be it spoken, his mind, even amid the glib loquacity of the guides, was duly and deeply touched with awe and enthusiastic admiration of all he saw. Certainly no adequate notion of these stupendous ruins can be formed, save by such as have visited them, and more especially by moonlight. Then the vast proportions of the building appear twice as large as when viewed by the mysterious beams of a southern moonlit sky, whose rays are sufficiently clear and vivid to gild the horizon with a glow equal to the soft twilight of an eastern clime. Scarcely, therefore, had the reflective France walked 100 steps beneath the interior porticoes of the ruin, than, abandoning Albert to the guides, France ascended a half-dilapidated staircase, and, leaving them to follow their monotonous round, seated himself at the foot of a column, and immediately opposite a large chasm, which permitted him to enjoy a full and undisturbed view of the gigantic dimensions of this majestic ruin. Fritz had remained for nearly a quarter of an hour, perfectly hidden by the shadow of the vast column, at whose base he had found a resting-place, and from whence his eyes followed the motions of Albert and his guides, when all at once his ear caught a sound resembling that of a stone rolling down the staircase opposite the one by which he had himself ascended. There was nothing remarkable in the circumstance of a morsel of granite giving way and falling heavily below, but it seemed to him that the substance that fell gave way beneath the pressure of a foot, and also that someone, who endeavoured as much as possible to prevent his footsteps from being heard, was approaching the spot where he sat. Conjecture soon became certainty, for the figure of a man was distinctly visible to Franz, gradually emerging from the staircase opposite, upon which the moon was at that moment pouring a full tide of silvery brightness. The stranger thus presenting himself was probably a person who, like Franz, preferred the enjoyment of solitude and his own thoughts to the frivolous gabble of the guides, and his appearance had nothing extraordinary in it. But the hesitation with which he proceeded onwards, stopping and listening with anxious attention at every step he took, convinced Franz he expected the arrival of some person. By a sort of instinctive impulse, Franz withdrew as much as possible behind his pillar. About 10 feet from the spot where himself and the stranger were placed, the roof had given way, leaving a large, round aperture, through which might be seen the blue vault of heaven thickly studded with stars. Around this opening, which had, possibly for ages, permitted a free entrance to the brilliant moonbeams that now illumined the vast pile, grew a quantity of creeping plants, whose delicate green branches stood out in bold relief against the clear azure of the firmament, while large masses of thick, strong, fibrous shoots forced their way through the chasm and hung floating to and fro like so many waving strings. The person whose mysterious arrival had attracted the attention of Franz stood in a kind of half-light that rendered it impossible to distinguish his features, although his dress was easily made out. He wore a large brown mantle, one fold of which, thrown over his left shoulder, served likewise to mask the lower part of his countenance, while the upper part was completely hidden by his broad-brimmed hat. The lower part of his dress was more distinctly visible by the bright rays of the moon, which, entering through the broken ceiling, shed their refulgent beams on feet cased in elegantly made boots of polished leather, over which descended fashionably cut trousers of black cloth. From the imperfect means Franz had of judging, he could only come to one conclusion, that the individual whom he was thus watching certainly belonged to no inferior station in life. Some few minutes had elapsed, and the stranger began to show manifest signs of impatience, when a slight noise was heard outside the aperture in the roof, and almost immediately a dark shadow seemed to obstruct the flood of light that had entered from it, and the figure of a man was clearly seen gazing with eager scrutiny on the immense space beneath them. Then, as his eye caught sight of the individual in the mantle, he grasped a floating mass of thickly matted boughs, and glided down by their help to within 3 or 4 feet of the ground, and then leapt lightly on his feet. The man who had performed this daring act with so much indifference wore the costume of Transtevere.
"I beg your Excellency's pardon for keeping you waiting," said the man, in the Roman dialect. "But I don't think I'm many minutes after my time. 10 o'clock has just struck by the clock of Saint-Jean-de-Latran."
"Say not a word about being late," replied the stranger in purest Tuscan. "'Tis I who am too soon. But even if you had caused me to wait a little while, I should have felt quite sure that the delay was not occasioned by any fault of yours."
"Your Excellency is perfectly right in so thinking," said the man. "I came here direct from the Chateau Saint-Ange."
"And what news did you glean?"
"That 2 executions of considerable interest will take place the day after tomorrow at 2 o'clock, as is customary at Rome at the commencement of all great festivals. One of the culprits will be Mazzolato. He is an atrocious villain who murdered the priest who brought him up, and deserves not the smallest pity. The other sufferer is sentenced to be decapitato, and he, your Excellency, is poor Peppino."
"The fact is that you have inspired not only the pontifical government, but also the neighbouring states with such extreme fear that they are glad of an opportunity of making an example."
"But Peppino did not even belong to my band. He was merely a poor shepherd whose only crime consisted in furnishing us with provisions."
"Which makes him your accomplice to all intents and purposes.
But mark the distinction with which he is treated. Instead of being knocked on the head, as you would be if once they caught hold of you, he is simply sentenced to be guillotined, by which means, too, the amusements of the day are diversified, and there is a spectacle to please every spectator.
Without reckoning the wholly unexpected one I am preparing to surprise them with."
"My good friend," said the man in the cloak, "excuse me for saying that you seem to me precisely in the mood to commit some wild or extravagant act.
Perhaps I am, but one thing I have resolved on, and that is to stop at nothing to restore a poor devil to liberty who has got into this scrape solely from having served me. I should hate and despise myself as a coward did I desert the brave fellow in his present extremity."
And what do you mean to do?
To surround the scaffold with 20 of my best men, who, at a signal from me, will rush forward directly Peppino is brought for execution, and, by the assistance of their stilettos, drive back the guard and carry off the prisoner.
That seems to me as hazardous as uncertain, and convinces me my scheme is far better than yours.
And what is your Excellency's project?
Just this.
I will so advantageously bestow 2,000 piastres that the person receiving them shall obtain a respite till next year for Peppino, and during that year another skilfully placed 1,000 piastres shall afford him the means of escaping from his prison. I can do more single-handed by the means of gold than you and all your troop could effect with stilettos, pistols, carbines, and blunderbusses included. Leave me then to act, and have no fears for the result.
At least there can be no harm in myself and party being in readiness, in case your Excellency should fail.
None whatever. Take what precautions you please, if it is any satisfaction to you to do so, but rely upon my obtaining the reprieve I seek.
Remember, the execution is fixed for the day after tomorrow, and that you have but one day to work in.
And what then? Is not a day divided into 24 hours, each hour into 60 minutes, and every minute subdivided into 60 seconds? Now in 86,400 seconds, very many things can be done.
And how shall I know whether your Excellency has succeeded or not?
Oh, that is very easily arranged. I have engaged the 3 lower windows at the Café Rospoli. Should I have obtained the requisite pardon for Peppino, the 2 outside windows will be hung with yellow damasks, and the centre with white, having a large cross in red marked on it.
And whom will you employ to carry the reprieve to the officer directing the execution?
Send one of your men, disguised as a penitent friar, and I will give it to him. His dress will procure him the means of approaching the scaffold itself, and will deliver the official order to the officer, who in his turn will hand it to the executioner. In the meantime, it will be as well to acquaint Peppino with what we have determined on, if it be only to prevent his dying of fear or losing his senses, because in either case a very useless expense will have been incurred.
"Your Excellency," said the man, "you are fully persuaded of my entire devotion to you, are you not?"
"Nay, I flatter myself that there can be no doubt of it," replied the cavalier in the cloak.
"Well then, only fulfil your promise of rescuing Peppino, and henceforward you shall receive not only devotedness, but the most absolute obedience from myself and those under me that one human being can render to another."
"Have a care how far you pledge yourself, my good friend, for I may remind you of your promises at some, perhaps not very distant, period, when I, in my turn, may require your aid and influence."
"Let that day come, soon or late, your Excellency will find me what I have found you in this my heavy trouble. And if from the other end of the world you but write me word to do such or such a thing, conclude it done. For done it shall be, on the word and faith of—"
"Hush!" interrupted the stranger. "I hear a noise."
"'Tis some travellers who are visiting the Colosseum by torchlight.
'Twere better we should not be seen together. Those guides are nothing but spies, and might possibly recognize you. And however I may be honoured by your friendship, my worthy friend, if once the extent of our intimacy were known, I am sadly afraid both my reputation and credit would suffer thereby."
"Well then, if you obtain the reprieve—"
"The middle window of the Café Rospoli will be hung with white damask, bearing on it a red cross."
"And if you fail?"
"Then all 3 windows will have yellow draperies."
"And then?"
"And then, my good fellow, use your daggers in any way you please, and I further promise you to be there as a spectator of your prowess."
"All is then understood between us. Adieu, your Excellency. Depend upon me as firmly as I do upon you."
Saying these words, the Trastevere disappeared down the staircase, while his companion, muffling his features more closely than before in the folds of his mantle, passed almost close to Franz, and descended to the arena by an outward flight of steps. The next minute Franz heard himself called by Albert, who made the lofty building re-echo with the sound of his friend's name. Franz, however, did not obey the summons till he had satisfied himself the 2 individuals, whose conversation he had thus surprised, were at a sufficient distance to prevent his encountering them in his descent, not wishing that they should suspect having had a witness to their discourse, who, if unable to recognize their faces, had at least heard every word that passed. In 10 minutes from the parting of the strangers, France was on the road to the Place d'Espagne. One of the two men whose mysterious rendezvous in the Colosseum he had so unintentionally witnessed was an entire stranger to him. But not so the other. And though Franz had been unable to distinguish his features from his being either wrapped in his mantle or obscured by the shadow, the tones of his voice had made too powerful an impression on him the first time he heard them for him ever again to forget them, hear them when or where he might. It was more especially when speaking in a manner half-jesting, half-bitter, that Franz's ear recalled most vividly the deep, sonorous, yet well-pitched voice that had spoken to him in the Grotto of Monte Cristo, and which he heard for the second time amid the darkness and ruined grandeur of the Colosseum. And the more he thought, the more entire was his conviction that the individual in the mantle was no other than his former host and entertainer, Sinbad the Sailor. Under any other circumstances, Franz would have found it impossible to resist his extreme curiosity to know more of so singular a personage, and with that intent have sought to renew their short acquaintance. But in the present instance, the confidential nature of the conversation he had overheard made him, with propriety, judge that his appearance at such a time would be anything but agreeable. As we have seen, therefore, he permitted his former host to retire without attempting a recognition, but fully promising himself a rich indemnity for his present forbearance, should chance afford him another opportunity. In vain did Franz endeavour to forget the many perplexing thoughts which assailed him. In vain did he court the refreshment of sleep. Worn out at length, he fell asleep at daybreak and did not awake till late. Like a genuine Frenchman, Albert had employed his time in arranging for the evening's diversion. He had sent to engage a box at the Teatro Argentino, and Franz, having a number of letters to write, relinquished the carriage to Albert for the whole of the day. At 5 o'clock Albert returned, delighted with his day's work. He had been occupied in leaving his letters of introduction, and had received in return more invitations to balls and soirées than it would be possible for him to fulfil. Besides this, he had seen, as he called it, all the remarkable sights at Rome. Yes, in a single day he had accomplished what his more reflective companion would have taken weeks to effect. Neither had he neglected to ascertain the name of the piece to be played that night at the Teatro Argentino, and also what performers appeared in it. The opera of Parisina was announced for representation, and the principal actors were Coselli, Mariani, and La Speche. The young men, therefore, had reason to consider themselves fortunate in having the opportunity of hearing one of the best works by the composer of Lucia di Lammermoor, supported by 3 of the most renowned vocalists of Italy. Albert had never been able to endure the Italian theatres, with their orchestras from which it is impossible to see, and the absence of balconies or open boxes. All these defects pressed hard on a man who had had his stall at the Opera Buffa and his share in the omnibus box at the Italian Opera. Still, in despite of this, Albert displayed his most dazzling and effective costume each time he visited the theatres. But alas, his recherché toilette was wholly thrown away, and one of the most worthy representatives of Parisian fashion had to carry with him the mortifying reflection of having nearly overrun Italy without meeting a single adventure. Sometimes Albert would affect to make a joke of his want of success, but internally he was deeply wounded, and his self-love immensely piqued to think that Albert de Morcerf, the most admired and most sought after of any young person of his day, should thus be passed over and merely have his labour for his pains. And the thing was so much the more annoying as, according to the characteristic modesty of a Frenchman, Albert had quitted Paris with the full conviction that he had only to show himself in Italy to carry all before him, and that upon his return he should astonish the Parisian world with a recital of his numerous love affairs. Alas, poor Albert. None of those interesting adventures fell in his way. The lovely Genoese, Florentine, and Neapolitan females were all faithful, if not to their husbands, at least to their lovers, and thought not of changing even for the splendid appearance of Albert de Morcerf. And all he gained was the painful conviction that the ladies of Italy have this advantage over those of France, that they are faithful even in their infidelity. Yet he could not restrain a hope that in Italy, as elsewhere, there might be an exception to the general rule. Albert, besides being an elegant, well-looking young man, was also possessed of considerable talent and ability. Moreover, he was a viscount, A recently created one, certainly, but in the present day it is not necessary to go back as far as Noah in tracing a descent, and a genealogical tree is equally estimated whether dated from 1399 or merely 1815. To crown all these advantages, Albert de Morcerf commanded an income of 50,000 livres, £2,000, a more than sufficient sum to render him a personage of considerable importance in Paris. Albert, however, hoped to indemnify himself for all these slights and indifferences during the carnival, knowing full well that among the different states and kingdoms in which this festivity is celebrated, Rome is the spot where even the wisest and gravest throw off the usual rigidity of their lives and deign to mingle in the follies of this time of liberty and relaxation. The carnival was to commence on the morrow. Therefore Albert had not an instant to lose in setting forth the programme of his hopes, expectations, and claims to notice. With this design he had engaged a box in the most conspicuous part of the theatre, and exerted himself to set off his personal attractions by the aid of the most recherché and elaborate toilette. The box taken by Albert was in the first circle. Although each of the three tiers of boxes is deemed equally aristocratic, it is, for this reason, generally styled the nobility's boxes, and although the box engaged for the two friends was sufficiently capacious to contain at least a dozen persons, it had cost less than would be paid at some of the French theatres for one admitting merely four occupants. Another motive had influenced Albert's selection of his seat. Who knew but that thus advantageously placed he could not fail to attract the notice of some fair Roman, and an introduction might ensue that would procure him the offer of a seat in a carriage, or a place in a princely balcony, from which he might behold the gaieties of the carnival. These united considerations made Albert more lively and anxious to please than he had hitherto been. Totally disregarding the business of the stage, he leaned from his box and began attentively scrutinizing the beauty of each pretty woman, aided by a powerful lorgnette. But, alas, this attempt to attract similar notice wholly failed. Not even curiosity had been excited, and it was but too apparent that the lovely creatures, into whose good graces he was desirous of stealing, were all so much engrossed with themselves, their lovers, or their own thoughts, that they had not so much as remarked him, or the pointing of his glass. Towards the close of the first act, the door of a box which had been hitherto vacant was opened. A lady entered to whom Franz had been introduced in Paris, where, indeed, he had imagined she still was. The quick eye of Albert caught the involuntary start with which his friend beheld the new arrival, and turning to him he said hastily, "Do you know the female who's just entered the box?" "Yes. What do you think of her?" "Oh, she's perfectly lovely. What a complexion! And such magnificent hair. Is she French?" "No, a Venetian. And her name is Countess G." "Ah, I know her name," exclaimed Albert. "She is said to possess as much wit and cleverness as beauty. I was to have been presented to her when I met her at Madame Villefort's ball."
"Shall I assist you in repairing your negligence?" asked Franz.
"My dear fellow, are you really on such good terms with her as to venture to take me to her box?"
"Why, I have only had the honour of being in her society and conversing with her three or four times in my life. But you know that even such an acquaintance as that might warrant my doing what you ask."
At this instant the Countess perceived Franz, and graciously waved her hand to him, to which he replied by a respectful inclination of the head.
"Upon my word," said Albert, "you seem to be on excellent terms with the beautiful Countess."
"You are mistaken in thinking so," returned Franz calmly, "but you merely fall into the same error which leads so many of our countrymen to commit the most egregious blunders. I mean that of judging the habits and customs of Italy and Spain by our Parisian notions."
"Well, be it so," said Albert. "But the question for the present is, are you going to keep your promise of introducing me to the fair subject of our remarks?"
"Certainly, directly the curtain falls on the stage."
"What a confounded time this first act is about! I believe on my soul that they never mean to finish it."
The curtain at length fell on the performances, to the infinite satisfaction of the Vicomte de Morcerf, who seized his hat, rapidly passed his fingers through his hair, arranged his cravat and wristbands, and signified to Franz that he was waiting for him to lead the way. Franz, who had mutely interrogated the Countess and received from her a gracious smile in token that he would be welcome, sought not to retard the gratification of Albert's eager impatience, but commenced at once the tour of the house, closely followed by Albert. They arrived at the Countess's box, and at the knock the door was immediately opened, and the young man, who was seated beside the Countess in the front of the loge, in obedience to the Italian custom, instantly rose and surrendered his place to the strangers, who, in turn, would be expected to retire upon the arrival of other visitors. Franz presented Albert as one of the most distinguished young men of the day, both as regarded his position in society and extraordinary talents. Nor did he say more than the truth, for in Paris, and the circle in which the Viscount moved, he was looked upon and cited as a model of perfection. Franz added that his companion, deeply grieved at having been prevented the honour of being presented to the Countess during her sojourn in Paris, was most anxious to make up for it, and had requested him, Franz, to remedy the past misfortune by conducting him to her box, and concluded by asking pardon for his presumption in having taken upon himself to do so. The Countess, in reply, bowed gracefully to Albert, and extended her hand with cordial kindness to Franz. Then, inviting Albert to take the vacant seat beside her, she recommended Franz to take the next best, if he wished to view the ballet, and pointed to the one behind her own chair. Albert was soon deeply engrossed in discoursing upon Paris and Paris matters, speaking to the Countess of the various persons they both knew there. Franz perceived how completely he was in his element, and, unwilling to interfere with the pleasure he so evidently felt, took up Albert's enormous lorgnette, and began, in his turn, to survey the audience. Sitting alone, in the front of a box immediately opposite, but situated on the third row, was a female of exquisite beauty, dressed in a Greek costume, which it was evident, from the ease and grace with which she wore it, was her national attire. Behind her, but in deep shadow, was the outline of a male figure. But the features of this latter personage it was not possible to distinguish. Franz could not forbear breaking in upon the apparently interesting conversation passing between the Countess and Albert, to inquire of the former if she knew who was the fair Albanese opposite, since beauty such as hers was well worthy of being remarked by either sex. "All I can tell you about her," replied the Countess, "is that she has been in Rome since the beginning of the season, for I saw her where she now sits the very first night of the theatre's opening, and since then she has never missed a performance, sometimes accompanied by the individual who is with her, and at others merely attended by a black servant." "And what do you think of her personal experience?" "Oh, I consider her perfectly lovely. She's just my idea of what Medora must have been." Franz and the Countess exchanged a smile, and then the latter resumed her conversation with Albert, while Franz returned to his previous survey of the house and company. The curtain rose on the ballet, which was one of those excellent specimens of the Italian school, admirably arranged and put on the stage by Henri, who has established for himself a great reputation throughout Italy for his taste and skill in the choreographic art. However much the ballet might have claimed his attention, Franz was too deeply occupied with the beautiful Greek to take any note of it, while she seemed to experience an almost childlike delight in watching it. Her eager, animated looks contrasting strongly with the utter indifference of her companion, who, during the whole time the piece lasted, never even moved, spite of the furious crashing din produced by the trumpets, cymbals, and Chinese bells, made to produce the loudest sound from the orchestra. The apathetic companion of the fair Greek took no heed of the deafening sounds that prevailed, but was, as far as appearances might be trusted, enjoying a soft repose and bright celestial dreams. The ballet at length came to a close, and the curtain fell amidst the loud, unanimous plaudits of an enthusiastic and delighted audience. Owing to the very judicious plan of dividing the two acts of the opera with a ballet, the pauses between the performances are very short. The singers in the opera having time to repose themselves and change their costume, when necessary, while the dancers are executing their pirouettes and exhibiting their graceful steps. The overture to the second act began, and at the first sound of the leader's bow across his violin, Franz observed the sleeper slowly arise and approach the Greek girl, who turned round to say a few words to him, and then leaning forward again on her box, she became as absorbed as before in what was going on. The countenance of the person who had addressed her remained so completely in the shade that though Franz tried his utmost, he could not distinguish a single feature. The curtain drew up, and the attention of Franz was attracted by the actors, and his eyes quitted their gaze at the box containing the Greek girl and her strange companion to watch the business of the stage. Most of my readers are aware that the second act of Parisina opens with a celebrated and effective duet, in which Parisina, while sleeping, betrays to Azzo the secret of her love for Ugo. The injured husband goes through all the workings of jealousy until conviction seizes on his mind, and then, in a frenzy of his rage and indignation, he awakens his guilty wife to tell her he knows her guilt and to threaten her with his vengeance. This duet is one of the finest conceptions that has ever emanated from the fruitful pen of Donizetti. Franz now listened to it for the third time, yet its notes, so tenderly expressive and fearfully grand, as the wretched husband and wife give vent to their different griefs and passions, thrilled through the soul of Franz with an effect equal to his first emotions upon hearing it. Excited beyond his usual calm demeanour, Franz rose with the audience, and was about to join the loud, enthusiastic applause that followed, but suddenly his purpose was arrested. His hands fell by his sides, and the half-uttered bravos expired on his lips. The occupant of the box in which the Greek girl sat appeared to share the universal animation that prevailed, for he left his seat to stand up in the front, so that his countenance being fully revealed, Franz had no difficulty in recognizing him as the mysterious inhabitant of Monte Cristo, and the very same individual he had encountered the previous evening in the ruins of the Colosseum, and whose voice and figure had seemed so familiar to him. All doubt of his identity was now at an end. His singular host evidently resided at Rome. The surprise and agitation occasioned by this full confirmation of Franz's former suspicion had no doubt imparted a corresponding expression to his features, for the Countess, after gazing with a puzzled look at his speaking countenance, burst into a fit of laughter and begged to know what had happened.
"Madame la Comtesse," returned Franz, totally unheeding her raillery, "I asked you a short time since if you knew any particulars respecting the Albanian lady opposite. I must now beseech you to inform me who and what is her husband."
End of Disc 11. Disc 12.
"Madame la Comtesse," returned Franz, totally unheeding her raillery, "I asked you a short time since if you knew any particulars respecting the Albanian lady opposite. I must now beseech you to inform me who and what is her husband."
"Nay," answered the Countess, "I know no more of him than yourself. Perhaps you never before remarked him."
"What a question! So truly French, do you not know that we Italians have eyes only for the man we love?"
"True," replied Franz.
"All I can say," continued the Countess, taking up the lorgnette and erecting it to the box in question, "is that the gentleman whose history I am unable to furnish seems to me as though he had just been dug up. He looks more like a corpse permitted by some friendly gravedigger to quit his tomb for a while and revisit this earth of ours than anything human. How ghastly pale he is!"
"Oh, he is always as colourless as you now see him," said Franz.
"Then you know him?" almost screamed the Countess. "Oh, pray do, for heaven's sake, tell us all about. Is he a vampire, or a resuscitated corpse, or what?"
"I fancy I have seen him before, and I even think he recognizes me."
"And I can well understand," said the Countess, shrugging up her beautiful shoulders, as though an involuntary shudder passed through her veins, "that those who have once seen that man will never be likely to forget him."
The sensation experienced by Franz was evidently not peculiar to himself. Another, and wholly uninterested person, felt the same unaccountable awe and misgiving.
"Well," inquired Franz, after the Countess had a second time directed her lorgnette at the loge of the mysterious vis-à-vis, "what do you think of our opposite neighbour?" "Why, that he is no other than Lord Riven himself in a living form."
This fresh allusion to Baron drew a smile to Franz's countenance, although he could but allow that if anything was likely to induce belief in the existence of vampires, it would be the presence of such a man as the mysterious personage before him.
"I must positively find out who and what he is," said Franz, rising from his seat.
"No, no," cried the Countess, "you must not leave me. I depend upon you to escort me home. Oh, indeed, I cannot permit you to go."
"Is it possible," whispered Franz, "that you entertain any fear?"
"I'll tell you," answered the Countess. "Byron had the most perfect belief in the existence of vampires, and even assured me he had seen some. The description he gave me perfectly corresponds with the features and character of the man before us. Oh, it is the exact personification of what I have been led to expect. The coal-black hair, large, bright, glittering eyes, in which a wild, unearthly fire seems burning, the same
ghastly paleness. Then observe, too, that the very female he has with him is altogether unlike all others of her sex. She is a foreigner, a stranger. Nobody knows who she is or where she comes from. No doubt she belongs to the same horrible race he does, and is, like himself, a dealer in magical arts. I entreat you not to go near him, at least to-night. And if to-morrow your curiosity still continues as great, pursue your researches if you will. But to-night you neither can nor shall. For that purpose I mean to keep you all to myself."
Franz protested he could not defer his pursuit till the following day, for many reasons.
"Listen to me," said the Countess, "and do not be so very headstrong. I am going home. I have a party at my house to-night, and therefore cannot possibly remain until the conclusion of the opera. Now I cannot for one instant believe you so devoid of gallantry as to refuse a lady your escort when she even condescends to ask you for it."
There was nothing else left for Franz to do but to take up his hat, open the door of the loge, and offer the Countess his arm. It was quite evident, by the Countess's manner, that her uneasiness was not feigned, and Franz himself could not resist a species of superstitious dread, so much the stronger in him as it arose from a variety of corroborating recollections, while the terror of the Countess sprung from an instinctive feeling originally created in her mind by the wild tales she had listened to till she believed them truths. Franz could even feel her arm tremble as he assisted her into the carriage. Upon arriving at her hotel, Franz perceived that she had deceived him when she spoke of expecting company. On the contrary, her own return before the appointed hour seemed greatly to astonish the domestics.
"Excuse my little subterfuge," said the Countess,
in reply to her companion's half-reproachful observation on the subject.
"But that horrid man had made me feel quite uncomfortable, and I longed to be alone that I might compose my startled mind."
Franz essayed to smile.
"Nay," said she, "smile not. It ill accords with the expression of your countenance, and I am sure it springs not from your heart. However, promise me one thing."
"What is that?"
"Promise me, I say. I will do anything you desire except relinquish my determination of finding out who this man is. I have more reason than you can imagine for desiring to know who he is, from whence he came, and whither he is going. Where he comes from, I am ignorant, but I can readily tell you where he is going to, and that is down below, without the least doubt."
"Let us only speak of the promise you wished me to make," said Franz.
"Well, then, you must give me your word to return immediately to your hotel, and make no attempt to follow this man to-night. There are certain affinities between the persons we quit and those we meet afterwards. For heaven's sake, do not serve as a conductor between that man and me. Pursue your chase after him to-morrow as eagerly as you please, but never bring him near me if you would not see me die of terror. And now, good night. Retire to your apartments, and try to sleep away all recollections of this evening. For my own part, I am quite sure I shall not be able to close my eyes."
So saying, the Countess quitted Franz, leaving him unable to decide whether she were merely amusing herself at his expense, or that her fears and agitations were genuine. Upon his return to the hotel, Franz found Albert in his dressing gown and slippers, listlessly extended on a sofa, smoking a cigar.
"My dear fellow," cried he, springing up, "is it really you? Why, I did not expect to see you before to-morrow."
"My dear Albert," replied Franz,
"I am glad of this opportunity to tell you once and for ever that you entertain a most erroneous notion concerning Italian females. I should have thought the continual failures you have met with in all your own love affairs might have taught you better by this time."
"Upon my soul, these women would puzzle the very devil to read them aright. Why, here they give you their hand, they press yours in return, they keep up a whispering conversation, permit you to accompany them home. Why, if a Parisian were to indulge in a quarter of these marks of flattering attention, her reputation would be gone for ever.
And the very reason why the females of this fine country put so little restraint on their words and actions is because they live so much in public, and have really nothing to conceal. Besides, you must have conceived that the Countess was really alarmed."
"At what? At the sight of that respectable gentleman sitting opposite to us in the same loge as the lovely Greek girl? Now, for my pair, I met them in the lobby after the conclusion of the piece, and hang me if I can guess where you took your notions of the other world from. I can assure you that this hobgoblin of yours is a deuced fine-looking fellow, admirably dressed. Indeed, I feel quite sure, from the cut of his clothes, that they are made by a first-rate Paris tailor, probably Blin or Humann. He was rather too pale, certainly, but then, you know, paleness is always looked upon as a strong proof of aristocratical descent and distinguished breeding."
Franz smiled, for he well remembered that Albert particularly prided himself on the entire absence of colour in his own complexion.
"Well, that tends to confirm my own ideas," said Franz, "that the Countess's suspicions were destitute alike of sense and reason. Did he speak in your hearing, and did you catch any of his words?"
"I did, but they were uttered in the Romaic dialect. I knew that from the mixture of Greek words. I don't know whether I ever told you that when I was at college I was rather strong in Greek."
"He spoke the Romaic language, did he?"
"I think so."
"That settles it," murmured Franz. "'Tis he, past all doubt."
"What do you say?"
"Nothing, nothing. But tell me, what were you thinking about when I came in?"
"Oh, I was arranging a little surprise for you."
"Indeed, of what nature?"
"Why, you know, it is quite impossible to procure a carriage."
"Certainly, and I also know that we have done all that human means afforded to endeavour to get one.
Now then, in this difficulty, a bright idea has flashed across my brain."
Franz looked at Albert as though he had not much confidence in the suggestions of his imagination.
"Well now, what do you say to a cart? I dare say such a thing might be had."
"Very possibly."
"And a pair of oxen?"
"As easily found as the cart."
"Then you see, my good fellow, with a cart and a couple of oxen our business can be managed.
The cart must be tastefully ornamented, and if you and I dress ourselves as Neapolitan reapers, we may get up a striking tableau, after the manner of that splendid picture by Leopold Robert. It would add greatly to the effect if the Countess would join us in the costume of a peasant from Puzzoli or Sorrento. Our group would then be quite complete, more especially as the Countess is quite beautiful enough to represent the mother with child."
"Well," said Franz, "this time, Monsieur Albert, I am bound to give you credit for having hit upon a most capital idea."
"And quite a national one, too," replied Albert, with gratified pride. "A mere mask, borrowed from our own festivities. Ha, ha, messieurs les Romains, you thought to make us unhappy strangers trot at the heels of your processions, like so many lazzaroni, because no carriages or horses are to be had in your beggarly city. But you don't know us. When we can't have one thing, we invent another."
"And have you communicated your triumphant idea to any person?"
"Only to our host. Upon my return home, I sent to desire he would come to me, and I then explained to him what I wished to procure. He assured me that nothing would be easier than to furnish all I desired. One thing I was sorry for: when I bade him have the horns of the oxen gilded, he told me there would not be time, as it would require 3 days to effect that. So you see, we must do without this little superfluity."
"And where is he now?"
"Who?"
"Our host."
"Gone out in search of our equipage. By tomorrow it might be too late."
"Then he will be able to give us an answer tonight?"
"Oh, I expect him every minute."
At this instant the door opened, and the head of Maître Pastrini appeared.
"Permesso?" inquired he.
"Certainly, certainly," cried Franz. "Come in, mine host."
"Now then," asked Albert eagerly, "have you found the desired cart and oxen?"
"Better than that," replied the Maître Pastrini, with the air of a man perfectly well satisfied with himself.
"Take care, my worthy host," said Albert. "Better is a sure enemy to well."
"Let your excellencies only leave the matter to me," returned Maître Pastrini, in a tone indicative of unbounded self-confidence.
"But what have you done?" asked Franz. "Speak out. There's a worthy fellow."
"Your excellencies are aware," responded the landlord, swelling with importance, "that the Count of Monte Cristo is living on the same floor with yourselves."
"I should think we did know it," exclaimed Albert, "since it is owing to that circumstance that we are packed into these small rooms like two poor students in the back streets of Paris."
"Well, the Count of Monte Cristo, hearing of the dilemma in which you are placed, has sent to offer you seats in his carriage and two places at his windows in the Palace Rospoli."
The friends looked at each other with unutterable surprise.
"But do you think," asked Franz, "that we ought to accept such offers from a perfect stranger?"
"What sort of person is this Count of Monte Cristo?" asked Franz of his host.
"A very great nobleman, but whether Maltese or Sicilian I cannot exactly say. But this I know, that he is noble as a Borghese and rich as a gold mine."
"It seems to me," said Franz, speaking in an undertone to Albert, "that if this individual merited the high panegyrics of our landlord, he would have conveyed his invitation through another channel, and not permitted it to be brought to us in this unceremonious way. He would have written, or—"
At this instant someone knocked at the door.
"Come in," said Franz.
A servant wearing a livery of considerable style and richness appeared at the threshold, and placing two cards in the landlord's hands, who forthwith presented them to the two young men, he said,
"Please to deliver these from Monsieur le Comte de Monte Cristo to Monsieur le Vicomte Albert de Morcerf and Monsieur Franz Epinay. Monsieur le Comte de Monte Cristo," continued the servant, "begs these gentlemen's permission to wait upon them as their neighbour, and he will be honoured by an intimation of what time they will please to receive him."
"Faith, France," whispered Albert, "there is not much to find fault with here."
"Tell the Count," replied France, "that we will do ourselves the pleasure of calling on him." The servant bowed and retired.
"That is what I call an elegant mode of attack," said Albert. "You were quite correct in what you stated, Maitre Pastrini. The Count of Monte Cristo is unquestionably a man of first-rate breeding and knowledge of the world."
"Then you accept his offer?" said the host.
"Of course we do," replied Albert. "Still, I must own I am sorry to be obliged to give up the cart and the group of reapers. It would have produced such an effect, and were it not for the windows at the Palace Rospoli, by way of recompense for the loss of our beautiful scheme, I don't know but what I should have held on by my original plan. What say you, France?"
"Oh, I agree with you. The windows in the Palace Rospoli alone decided me." The truth was that the mention of two places in the Palace Rospoli had recalled to France's mind the conversation he had overheard the preceding evening in the ruins of the Colosseum between the mysterious unknown and the Trastevere, in which the stranger in the cloak had undertaken to obtain the freedom of a condemned criminal. And if this muffled-up individual proved, as France felt sure he would, the same as the person he had just seen in the Teatro Argentino, then he should be able to establish his identity, and also to prosecute his researches respecting him with perfect facility and freedom. The next day must clear up every doubt, and unless his near neighbour and would-be friend, the Count of Monte Cristo, possessed the ring of Gyges, and by its power were able to render himself invisible, it was very certain he could not escape this time. 8 o'clock found France up and dressed, while Albert, who had not the same motives for early rising, was still profoundly asleep. The first act of France was to summon his landlord, who presented himself with his accustomed obsequiousness.
"Pray, Maitre Pastrini," asked France, "is not some execution appointed to take place today?"
"Yes, Your Excellence, but if your reason for inquiry is that you may procure a window to view it from, you are much too late."
"Oh, no," answered France, "I had no such intention, and even if I had felt a wish to witness the spectacle, I might have done so from Montepincio, could I not?"
"Ah," exclaimed mine host, "I did not think it likely Your Excellence would have chosen to mingle with such a rabble as are always collected on that hill, which indeed they consider as exclusively belonging to themselves."
"Very possibly I may not go," answered France, "but in case I feel disposed, give me some particulars of today's executions."
"That happens just lucky, Your Excellence. Only a few minutes ago they brought me the tavolettas."
"What are they?"
"Sort of wooden tablets hung up at the corners of streets the evening before an execution, on which is pasted up a paper containing the names of the condemned persons, their crimes, and mode of punishment. The reason for so publicly announcing all this is that all good and faithful Catholics may offer up their prayers for the unfortunate culprits, and above all, beseech of heaven to grant them a sincere repentance."
"And these tablets are brought to you, that you may add your prayers to those of the faithful, are they?" asked France, somewhat incredulously.
"Oh, dear, no, Your Excellence. I have not time for anybody's affairs but my own and those of my honourable guests. But I make an agreement with the man who pastes up the papers, and he brings them to me as he would the playbills, that in case any person staying at my hotel should like to witness an execution, he may obtain every requisite information concerning the time and place, etc."
"Upon my word, that is most delicate attention on your part, Maitre Pastrini," cried France.
"Why, Your Excellence,"
returned the landlord, chuckling and rubbing his hands with infinite complacency,
"I think I may take upon myself to say I neglect nothing to deserve the support and patronage of the noble visitors to this poor hotel."
"I see that plainly enough, my most excellent host, and you may rely upon my repeating so striking a proof of your attention to your guests wherever I go. Meanwhile, oblige me by a sight of one of these tavolettas."
"Nothing can be easier than to comply with Your Excellence's wish," said the landlord, opening the door of the chamber. "I've caused one to be placed on the landing, close by your apartment."
Then, taking the tablet from the wall, he handed it to Franz, who read as follows.
The public is informed that on Wednesday, February the 23rd, being the first day of the Carnival, two executions will take place in the Place del Popolo, by order of the Tribunal della Rota, of two individuals named Andrea Rondola and Peppino, otherwise called Rocco Priori. The former found guilty of the murder of a venerable and exemplary priest named Don Cesar Torlini, canon of the Church of Saint-Jean de Latran, and the latter convicted of being an accomplice of the atrocious and sanguinary bandit Luigi Vampa and his troop. The first-named malefactor will be Mazzolato, the second culprit Decapitato. The prayers of all good Christians are entreated for these unfortunate men, that it may please God to awaken them to a sense of their guilt, and to grant them a hearty and sincere repentance for their crimes. This was precisely what Franz had heard the evening before in the ruins of the Colosseum. No part of the programme differed. The names of the condemned persons, their crimes and mode of punishment, all agreed with his previous information. In all probability, therefore, the Transtevere was no other than the bandit Luigi Vampa himself, and the man shrouded in the mantle the same he had known as Sinbad the Sailor, but who, no doubt, was still pursuing his philanthropic expedition in Rome, as he had already done at Porto Vecchio and Tunis. Time was getting on, however, and Franz deemed it advisable to awaken Albert. But at the moment he prepared to proceed to his chamber, his friend entered the saloon in perfect costume for the day. The anticipated delights of the Carnival had so run in his head as to make him leave his pillow long before his usual hour. "Now, my excellent Maitre Pastrini," said Franz, addressing his landlord, "since we are both ready, do you think we may proceed at once to visit the Count of Monte Cristo?"
"Most assuredly," replied he. "The Count of Monte Cristo is always an early riser, and I can answer for his having been up these 2 hours."
"Well, then, if it be so, are you ready, Albert?"
"Perfectly."
Let us go and return our best thanks for his courtesy." The landlord preceded the friends across the landing, which was all that separated them from the apartments of the Count, rang at a bell, and upon the door being opened by a servant, said,
"I signori Francesi."
The domestic bowed respectfully, and invited them to enter. They passed through 2 rooms, furnished with a style and luxury they had not calculated on finding under the roof of Maitre Pastrini, and were shown into an elegantly fitted-up saloon. The richest Turkey carpets covered the floor, and the softest and most inviting couches, bergères, and sofas offered their high-piled and yielding cushions to such as desired repose or refreshment. Splendid paintings by the first masters were ranged against the walls, intermingled with magnificent trophies of war, while heavy curtains of costly tapestry were suspended before the different doors of the room.
"If your excellencies will please to be seated," said the man, "I will let Monsieur le Comte know you are here."
And with these words he disappeared behind one of the tapestried portières. As the door opened, the sound of a guzla reached the ears of the young men, but was almost immediately lost, for the rapid closing of the door merely allowed one rich swell of harmony to enter the saloon. Franz and Albert looked inquiringly at each other, then at the gorgeous fittings-up of the apartment. All seemed even more splendid at a second view than it had done at their first rapid survey.
"Well," said Franz to his friend, "what think you of all this?"
"Why, upon my soul, my dear fellow, it strikes me our elegant and attentive neighbour must either be some successful stock-jobber who has speculated in the fall of the Spanish funds, or some prince travelling incog."
"Hush, hush," replied Franz. "We shall ascertain who and what he is. He comes."
As Franz spoke, he heard the sound of a door turning on its hinges, and almost immediately afterwards the tapestry was drawn aside, and the owner of all these riches stood before the 2 young men. Albert instantly rose to meet him, but Franz remained, in a manner spellbound, on his chair, for in the person of him who had just entered he recognized not only the mysterious visitant to the Colosseum, and the occupant of the loge at the Salle Argentino, but also his singular host of Monte Cristo.